You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Cheryl Hooper was a devoted, loving mom, daughter, and friend to her family and all those that knew her. Tragically, she was murdered by her controlling and jealous husband in a premeditated act of the most savage violence. On Friday, the 26th of January, 2018, Andrew Jack Hooper committed the cowardly act of killing his wife. The act was witnessed by innocent members of the public, who too have suffered greatly from the trauma of witnessing such a barbaric act. Andrew Hooper continued his controlling and cowardly behaviour by refusing to acknowledge his actions and forcing a young girl, traumatised by the incident, to give evidence at a Crown Court trial. I hope that Hooper spends the rest of his life reflecting on the devastation that he has caused. The impact of this crime will live forever in the hearts and minds of Cheryl's family. Not only have they lost a treasured loved one, but they have had to rebuild their lives as a consequence. We've all been overwhelmed by the bravery of Cheryl's family, and I hope that today's verdict provides them with a little relief from their pain.
Hey there, lovely listeners. I wanted to share with you part one of three very special interviews with an incredibly inspiring, courageous and brave 17-year-old girl, Georgia Gabriel Hooper. Now, when Georgia was 14 years old, her mother Cheryl was shot dead in front of her on January the 26th, 2018. Cheryl's murder shocked not only the quiet community of Newport, but resonated across Shropshire and across the UK. It's even more horrific because Georgia was with her mum at the time, in the car when Andrew Hooper appeared late one night, armed with a shotgun. Georgia wants to ensure her mother's murder is not in vain, and she wants to help others understand coercive control and stalking and the child's perspective, which is often overlooked. Now, this is a very honest, real, and at times harrowing and heartbreaking conversation. But it's a very necessary conversation everyone needs to hear. This was a murder in slow motion, and we want everyone to understand the red flags and the warning signs of coercive control and stalking. This conversation may open up a lot of things for you, particularly if you've experienced domestic abuse as a child or in adulthood, and it may be triggering or upsetting, so listener discretion is advised. Georgia is also campaigning alongside me for the Register for Serial Domestic Abusers and Stalkers. She firmly believes that had this been in place, her mother Cheryl would still be alive today. And I totally agree with Georgia. Too often it's women and children who are terrorised, abused, harmed and killed. And we want to change this. We desperately want to change this, and we also need your help. So listen to the end of the interview about how you can help us to ensure that serial domestic abusers and stalkers are on the same register as sex offenders and terrorists. And so, without further ado, here's my interview with the amazing and inspiring Georgia Gabriel Hooper. Hi, Georgia. It's great to see you and great to speak with you. And thank you for coming on to Crime Analyst to talk to me. Will you introduce yourself to everyone, please?
Hi, yes. So, yeah, as you've just said, you know, I'm Georgia. I'm from Shropshire in England. So it's, you know, small place, very rural. I'm 17 and yeah, I'm a survivor of domestic abuse, and hopefully sharing my experience will have some impact on some people.
Absolutely. Well, you're a survivor and you're incredible. And I remember first meeting you in Wales at a domestic violence conference, standing up to domestic violence, which Rachel Williams hosted. And we were both speaking at that conference. And I think you spoke before me and I was blown away.
Yeah, just before.
Yeah, that's right. I was blown away by what you had to say. What you said about your mum, Cheryl, and I remember your mum's case. I remembered reading it in the papers at the time. And we didn't talk much at the conference because it was such a busy day, but we've been talking ever since, haven't we?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you're very busy, you know, and I try not to command too much of your time, but yeah, we do talk quite a bit, don't we?
We do, and we talk specifically about what we want to change because of what happened to your mum. And the register is a very important part of change and what you and I have been campaigning for. So I want to hear a little bit from you, first of all. And I know my listeners would really love to hear about you and your mum and about your relationship before we talk about what actually happened. So can you characterise your mum and tell us a little bit about her?
I mean, it's very easy for, you know, when someone has, you know, passed away, it's very easy to say, you know, oh, they're amazing, they were this, that and the other. And it's very generic, and it's, you know, something you hear a lot from, you know, when someone talks about their loved one. But, you know, so I'm not going to be as generic as that, because, yeah, like I said, it's very easy to then be quite, you know, oh, well, everyone says that. And it doesn't quite go in as much as, you know, as sort of specific things do. But, you know, my mum was incredibly generous. You know, she was always given to charity. She was given to, I don't know how many charities, but it was too many. You know, she was always going, oh, I've not got much money left now. You know, and she bent over backwards to, you know, primary school, she put me in private school. And she bent over backwards to put me in there. There was times where she couldn't, you know, she could hardly afford to pay bills, really, because of paying for school for me, because all she cared about was my education and, you know, making sure that I had, you know, my home life wasn't great. So making sure that I had a greater education and, you know, as good of a start as I possibly could have, really, given the circumstances that we were living in. You know, and going back to the charity thing, one of the charities she gave to was a charity called Compassion, and we sponsored a child in Kenya. She's 2 years younger than me, and we used to send £25 a month, I think it was, and that paid for her to go to school, paid for her to have clothes, you know, X, Y, and Z. And unfortunately, you know, when my mum died, obviously, you know, I was concerned because I couldn't carry on those donations, and, you know, because that was so fun, you know, fundamental to them. There were four children in the family, so there was quite a lot of children for them to look after, and they were, you know, they were incredibly poor, and, you know, this child had massive dreams. I used to write to her a lot, and it really did go show just how much your money changed their lives. And, you know, doing what my mum would have wanted, and I know 100% she would have wanted this, at her funeral, we had a donations plate, and we raised over £1,000 that day. And that was sent directly to their family. And, you know, they've been able to build two houses, rent them out, all the children get education, food, water, everything they could dream of. You know, they're now some of the wealthiest people in their town. So it's really special to see the impact that my mum has had, because I would never have been able to give them that money if my mum hadn't decided to sponsor her. You know, so, and everyone I've ever spoken to, really, I've never really heard a bad word said about my mum. I mean, I know people don't tend to talk people down to you, but even so, you know, just to see the outpouring of grief from my town, really, you know, she's very well known, just goes to show just sort of, you know, what a good person she was.
And when I've seen pictures of you and your mum together, because you shared quite a few pictures with me, the smiles on both your faces, you just light up the room. And I can see from her this light that resonated. So tell me a little bit about her. It sounds like she had great compassion, for example, that she left a legacy of wanting to help. She she wanted to make sure that you had a great education, but things weren't always easy, were they? And she put you first, it sounds like. And she was smart, intelligent, great fun. Just tell us a little bit about her characteristics of how she was when she was with you and with her friends, because she was bubbly, wasn't she?
Oh, crikey. She was certainly the loudest person in the room. I'll give her that. You know, she was quite well known for her laugh because it was such a cackle. And you could just recognise it anywhere. We were away at a Christian festival one time and we couldn't find, me and my friends had gone off and we weren't entirely sure where our parents were because they'd gone to sort of another friend's tent. And then I just heard this laugh from, you know, 100 yards away near enough. And it was, we found where the tent was pretty quickly just because we could hear my mum laughing, you know, so she was very, very well known for a laugh, but very, you know, very chatty. It runs in my family to be incredibly chatty. You can't shut us up. You can't get a word in edgeways, as you'll probably find doing this. You know, it's just, yeah, we're all incredibly chatty. My mum just was always wanting to help people. She'd never say no. That was also her downfall. She could never say no to people, you know, and often she'd push herself too hard and too far, you know, and she was incredibly forgiving too. That was the other thing, that was her other downfall, you know. She was incredibly forgiving and you know, forgave too much at times. But yeah, she was an incredibly compassionate person, funny. Her sarcasm was, you know, very British, let's put it that way. But she taught me that from quite a young age, so I was quite used to getting sarcastic remarks, one of which was I was having a strop once. And my stepsister said to me, why don't you just go and see your friends? Because my mum was all about going out. And my mum just turned around without even thinking and went, she doesn't have any, that's why. And, you know, just so quick-witted. And we all just ended up in hysterics. It certainly snapped me out of my strop straight away. Just how funny she was, really, and just very dry, just quite very quick-witted, very on the ball. So, yeah, but there was always never a dull moment, certainly so.
I love that. And what about your dad? Because you didn't really have much to do with your dad. Can you say a little bit about that, about who he was and why you decided, why you don't have any contact with him now?
I mean, my parents met before I was born. They got married before I was born. You know, they'd been together for quite a number of years. And he sort of started going downhill at a certain point. He himself didn't have particularly the best childhood with his father. And, you know, that sort of reflected in his behaviour as he got older. You know, he did gamble a lot. You know, there isn't really a problem with gambling. I don't have a problem with anyone gambling, but his... he took it too far and it became an addiction, unfortunately. And, you know, he was losing more than he was making. And, you know, that obviously led to massive problems within the relationship. He took some money of mine when I was a baby and my savings that my mum had been putting together. And, you know, he said he'd return them and he never did because he lost it all. He also had really bad alcohol issues. And, you know, he would drink while driving, you know, never mind drink and driving, you know, so it just, his behaviour just, you know, he became very distant. He wasn't really interested in me. He was just more interested in going to the pub and drinking with his friends and just, you know, drinking his life away, really, and gambling his life away. And their relationship broke down eventually, when I was two. And... you know, he was interested in seeing me for, you know, a period of time. However, you know, once he'd sort of got, he had to have supervised contact at first, but, you know, he was allowed to take me on his own after. And once he sort of was allowed to have that contact and allowed to have me, and it wasn't supervised contact, it sort of dwindled. You know, he'd quite often he wouldn't show up or he'd cancel last minute. And you know, as a 3, 4, 5 year old child, it's quite difficult to understand why he wouldn't turn up and why he wouldn't want to see me, you know. So there would be periods of time he was meant to see me every other weekend, but and I'd never stay over. I wasn't comfortable staying over, but he'd see me both days, and you know, there'd be periods of time where I wouldn't see him for 6 weeks or so because he just wouldn't show up, you know, unfortunately. And yeah, he never really provided for me the way a father should. And I'd sort of realised probably about 5 or 6 years ago that actually I was better off just not seeing him full stop, as it was more draining and more exhausting. I think the real downfall for him was he's engaged now, he's going to get married this year, but his partner who he's with now, he met her probably when I was about 5 or 6, possibly a bit older. And, you know, I think she was really the main downfall, unfortunately. She encouraged his behaviours, and, you know, it just, he's now a lot worse than he was before. And, you know, his priorities aren't the same as they were, 10 years ago, let's put it that way.
There are so many benefits of microdosing, and all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And who doesn't want that in life? I love how helpful these gummies are. For me, half a microdose gummy on the weekend helps me stay centered and fresh as I work out and get everything done on my weekend to-do list. One gummy, about 30 minutes before I go to bed, helps me relax at night and really be present in the moment, instead of worrying about things from that day or thinking about what's coming tomorrow. Get 30% off your first order, plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST, for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST.
So it sounds like your mom really was your rock, always there, always consistent, always putting you first, and was a fantastic mother and role model in your life.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I've got a small family anyway. You know, if you exclude my dad's side, I've got just my mum. I have my mum, my nan and my granddad, and my uncle and my cousin. And that's all I had really. So I'm quite used to having, you know, small, tight-knit. And, you know, I'm very lucky to have my nan and granddad. My uncle lives in Wales, so he lives a fair way away. You know, it's only an hour or so, but not for regular contact, really.
Yeah. So what happened after your dad sort of exited your life? Was your mum seeing someone else or before Andrew Hooper?
So at the time where I was sort of having contact with my dad, this is when I was still seeing him. You know, she had another partner at this point. Anyway, I was probably about 3 or 4 when they met. I think I can't really remember. But they were together for a couple of years, and we lived together. But he sort of he lived up north in Leeds or around that area, and he moved down to us, but he refused to move into my mum's property. He, you know, sort of said, you need to sell the house and buy another house with me, which, you know, effectively, as you and I both know, that's just a way of you know, tying her down and making it, you know, more difficult for her to then leave and then choose to exit the relationship because she was tied down with money. You know, so that was sort of that was the first downfall in that situation, really. And then over the years, he got progressively worse, and he was unfortunately very physically abusive, but towards myself rather than my mum. But he knew that because, you know, I was everything to my mum, really, and he knew that he could get at her that way. He knew that she wouldn't really care if the violence was directed at her, because at least I was okay. But yeah, he would direct that violence at me. And, you know, it did have a lot of repercussions in the sense of, you know, it taught me to be quite hard-faced. You know, I was very hard-faced growing up. You know, nothing if I was ever threatened to get my bum smacked, you know, I wouldn't run away and do as I was told. I'd just go on then, you know, because it didn't bother me as such. I mean, as I've got older, I've grown out of that. But at that time, it taught me, you know, bad values. The violence was mostly directed at myself, like I said. We did move out. We went and live with my nan and granddad for nearly a year, I think. But that was only temporarily. And then we went back to the other place and living back with him. I mean, fortunately, it was a big house. It was a 5-bedroom house, you know, detached, massive house. So we were quite lucky in the sense that we had that space away from each other. And, you know, we could kind of function without really seeing each other. However, we did have 3 locks on the master bedroom door. One at the top, one in the middle, one at the bottom, which, you know, looking back now, that is just absolutely absurd. But when I was probably 4 or 5 when this happened, that is just, that's just normal, you know, that at that stage in life. And at that point, I didn't even question the fact that we were putting locks on the door. I just knew that I felt safer with them, you know. But it was really difficult for my mum, especially having to explain to a, you know, 4 or 5-year-old why they can't sleep in their own bedroom. You know, all I wanted was to be able to sleep in my own bedroom, not have to sleep in the master bedroom with my mum, and, you know, running out of the house in the morning quickly and eating dinner at my nan and granddad's, then coming home late at night and going straight to bed. So it was a very, very difficult situation. But I mean, fortunately, we managed to sell the house eventually, and, you know, we did move out and escape that relationship.
So what were the locks on the door for, the 3 on the master bedroom? They were to keep you and your mum in, or...?
To keep him out. Yeah, we had the locks on the inside, so we could go to bed at night and lock ourselves in and feel safe, you know. And my mum was always trying to find out. She had a recording device that she sat keeping her bra, actually, funnily enough, just in case, you know, when he was around, so that if there was any sort of altercation of any kind, we could go to the police. He put tacks on the drive, nails in our tyres. My mum had a blowout on the motorway doing, you know, 70 in the outside lane. So she was very lucky not to crash. You know, and we found out that that was through a nail that he'd put in our tyre. We did report to the police, both the tacks on the drive and the nail in the tyre. However, their response was, it's on his property. So therefore, because it's on his property, he can do what he likes. Whether that had intent, you know, even though that action had intent to harm and it nearly did kill someone, then, you know, it didn't matter, apparently, because it was on his personal property, and there was nothing they could really do.
That's outrageous. I mean, this is where the context is missing of all the other behaviours that were going on, and having 3 locks on a door to stop him getting in and you being fearful. I mean, we've talked a little bit about it, and I always say, particularly children growing up in an environment where there is an abuser and there's fear in the room, it is so corrosive to a child's development, that fear and just never knowing what's happening next and what's coming next. I think it's really important children know that they are victims too, and that they're not just witnesses. And too often that's how police and other agencies treat children. And I know that growing up myself and what I've experienced, and oftentimes you're not seen as a person. And I think that with what you described, there are multiple opportunities for the police to ask questions about everything that's going on, the totality. And I think this really set the stage for when your mum meets Andrew Hooper, because it's not just about one relationship. It's actually about the story of your life and how things happen, of having a dad who puts gambling and his alcohol addiction first, and how that must have felt for you, because it's not easy for a child to know and understand and reason. You don't know all those reasons. You just don't feel loved, and you don't feel seen, you don't feel heard, you don't feel important. And then there's this next relationship where he's being, in some ways, worse. There's some physical abuse, but again, you're living in fear. And you and your mum did nothing to warrant that level of behaviour. And I know you know that now. because that's another important thing. It takes a long time to work these things out, doesn't it? And it stays with us. It doesn't matter what age we are. Our stories stay with us when we experience abuse. And I'm glad that you and your mum got away safely in that situation. And I don't know what the time frame was here, Georgia, for when Andrew Hooper comes on the scene. What can you remember roughly what the timescales were and when your mum met him?
So my mum was with this previous partner from probably when I was about 3 till about 5 or 6. And then she met Andrew 2 weeks after my 7th birthday, actually. That was their first official date, really, because they were set upon a blind date. My mum had never done it before. It wasn't her thing. But funnily enough, actually, they both had the same divorce lawyer for their previous marriages. And they were both, you know, they weren't just clients. They were friends with him. And he said, let me just set you up with someone, it worked, but it worked a little too well, really, for my liking. And, unfortunately, as we know, it went downhill afterwards. But it's very right what you say about how sort of detrimental it is to, your upbringing, really. Even now at 17 and with all the work I do, I mean, I've been involved in the domestic abuse sector for 2 years now, really, and a little bit before that. But even now, I'm still learning things about what I went through when I was 5. And there were so many questions I had, and it was so confusing for such a large amount of time. Like I said, even now, there's behaviours that I go, hold on a minute, really, that's not normal. Lots of different things like that. And it really does concern me. This is a different topic, but it really does concern me that I am only learning these things because of coming into the domestic abuse sector. I never learnt these at school. I never learnt these from anyone else, but I learnt them, because of my mum dying, and because of wanting to help and wanting to change other people's lives, where it just baffles me that that's not just standard. All the relationships were very close together and everything. I agree with everything you said. It's very detrimental. You do feel very, left out, really. And I spent a lot of my time very confused as to what was going on, really, and why no one wanted me. I mean, I've found booklets and notepads from when, because my mum kept everything of mine. I found notepads and little diaries and things that I had from when I was younger, and in them it'd be like, why don't they want me, why don't they love me, what am I doing wrong, and then why doesn't mum want me? She's more interested in her new partner now, what's going on, because she was so desperate to make things work and so desperate to give me a good life that oftentimes she would kind of not once she was in the relationship with Andrew, but very much at the start, because she was she wanted to make it work. She was just doing everything he sort of asked her to do, because he wasn't physically violent. So this was a massive change for her. She had domestic, abusive relationships before I was even born. It wasn't a new sequence of events for her. So for him to not be physically violent, like her other partners, was actually a massive change. And she was like, I've struck gold here. And she was so desperate to be loved. And she said this all the way through the relationship, very much, especially right at the end as well. She said, I'm so desperate to be loved. Why will no one love me? Because she tried so hard, yet she got nothing in return. And, because she tried so hard, she would put me on the back burner a bit, and she'd put me to bed. When he'd come over, she put me to bed like 2 hours before my normal bedtime because he didn't want to see me. He wasn't interested in me. He didn't particularly like me. So because she wanted to please him, she put me to bed. But then that obviously left me with so many different questions. And for a period of time, feeling quite neglected, really, is the only answer to it. Fortunately, I had my nan and granddad, and they sort of explained it to me, and then eventually things settled down and they were sort of okay between myself and my mum again. But it certainly had a massive effect on me for quite a significant period of time.
I can imagine. And I think what you said first of all, when you were saying, well, at school, no one really taught me about this, healthy relationships and what does it look like? And there are so many children growing up with an abuser in their home feeling exactly this conflicted, it's me, there's something wrong with me, I'm not loved, I'm not wanted, I'm always in trouble. And it's really hard for children to understand because they haven't got the wealth of wisdom that you have when you're much older. And I think that's why it's so important that we don't just teach children when they're age appropriate, the mechanics of sex. We actually should be teaching them about what's a healthy relationship. And I think it is still very conflicting for many, even when you're in adulthood, to change and unlearn the patterns that you've learned. And I think a lot of adult life is actually unlearning things that have been unhealthy and don't serve us very well. And I know that you're in the middle of that process, and the work is the work. You have to do the work every day. And that's why you can talk so eloquently and help so many other people who are going through it. And some who have even gone through it think that they've dealt with it as childhood survivors and probably haven't, because a lot of people put this stuff in a box and never open that box again. And I'm sure some of our listeners, this will really resonate with them. And I think what you said about your mom as well, you know, the change in relationship when a man comes on the scene, because she's trying to create a family environment for you. And so she's investing her time. But for you as a child, it feels really uncomfortable. What have I done wrong? Why aren't you spending the time with me? Because you don't really understand. And particularly if men like lay down that rule, well, I want to see you, but I'm not ready to see your child. So in essence, you feel like you're being punished. You're being put to bed early again when you've done nothing wrong. And I think that's very confusing, that messaging. And for your mom also, it's confusing because she understood physical violence, but what she probably didn't understand was the control and how control starts to creep in at even the beginning of a relationship, where it can look like it's romance, it can look like attention, but actually most oftentimes it's about control. And I think that was a very smart observation on your behalf, that because Andrew Hooper showed up in a different way, and I remember you describing him to me and saying things like, at first he was lovely, he was intelligent, he was smart, he was charming. I remember you using the C word, charming, and instantly the red flag popped for me. And I wondered how much of that charm was about manipulation rather than anything else.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
And it seemed that you picked these things up quite early on with him, but not always do people. And it sounds like your mum didn't. She saw him as being charming and she wanted to carry on having a relationship with him. And she wanted to please him, you said. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I did not get on with him from the start, really. And, you know, I was more difficult, you know, harder to win over than my mum was, really, because I was so skeptical, not just for my own safety, really, but, you know, I was so used to, you know, unfortunately, I never had the beauty of the parent-child relationship. I spent most of the time being the parent, really, you know, and picking my mum up and making sure she was okay, because I was so used to living in that environment. You know, it was all I'd ever known. I was born into it. So, you know, that was something, you know, it didn't really spark too many emotions with me. You know, I was quite capable of just picking my mum up and dealing with it. Whereas, you know, she would get really upset. And, you know, she had three miscarriages, unfortunately, very early on into their relationship, because, you know, she was in her 40s. And the first one was caused by, they went on holiday and she was sat on the plane too long. And, you know, it caused an infection. And you know, unfortunately she did lose it and she lost the next two. And every time he ran away and he blamed her, and, you know, it was her fault and she was dirty and disgusting because she'd lost it. And because he ran away and he'd, you know, he'd be really hurt and upset about it, that would just make her feel even more guilty because she was like, well, I've hurt him, I've upset him, you know, whereas that's just nature, unfortunately. You know, these things happen, and, you know, they should have stuck together through it. However, he left her alone with no one. And I was, you know, myself and her friends, we were the only ones there to pick her up. And late at night when you're on your own and there's no one else in the house, and your friends have gone to bed, who can you call on? Your child. So, you know, I was left to pick up the pieces, and I just never gelled to him. I just really picked up a bad vibe from him. And I think, unfortunately, well, I wouldn't really say unfortunately, but he kind of sensed that I'd figured him out. And I tried many times to tell my mum, I don't like him, there's something not right about him. You know, I mean, I was just as guilty as she was, though, for falling for his charm. I'm not going to deny that. There were many times where I was like, oh, he's great. But it would always boil back down to, do you know what? I don't really like him. It was, you know, we'd go out and we'd have great days out, or I'd go out with him on his farm and I'd love it. But then when it came back to, you know, the weekend, for example, having Sunday dinner, we'd go out on the farm in the morning when we came back in, and when we were sat together, it just didn't work. There was just something not quite right. And, you know, yeah, like I said to you before, and you've mentioned it, he was very charming. And I 100% believe that that was just the act of manipulation, you know, him waiting to get her where he wanted her, and then slowly change. You know, his friends called him Lordy. That's not a normal thing, really, to call your friend Lordy. You know, he had his own farm. He drove a Range Rover. He thought he was it. And he was, you know, a lot more wealthy than his friends. And therefore he felt that he deserved the title of Lordy, you know, and, well, Lordy or the Lord, because he really did think he was Lord of the Manor, you know. And that was another sort of big thing for me. I was like, well, I don't understand why his friends look up to him so much. You know, he isn't really anything special. But yeah, I didn't get on with him really at all. And because he knew I'd sussed him out, he didn't want really anything to do with me, because he also knew that my mum valued my opinion very highly. And if I wasn't happy, then she would have left. So for him, you know, he had to try and isolate my, you know, me away from my mum, really. My mum away from me, so that she'd be just all ears on him and not listen to me and anyone else around. And, you know, he'd always put it down to, oh, well, she doesn't know me very well yet. She's not going to like me. Or because in that period of time, he never really let me spend too much time around him, so that my mum could say, oh, well, you don't really know him yet. And then by the time we did end up spending more time together, the damage was already done. You know, she was already under his spell, really, and, you know, wrapped around his little finger. He could do whatever he wanted. And nothing that I said or nothing that my nan and granddad said would ever really be louder than his voice.
What did your nan and granddad think about him?
Exactly the same as what I thought, really. They were not a fan of him. You know, they got married 4 years into their relationship, and my nan and granddad said to her, don't marry him. You know, we all sort of said the same. I was hoping, because I was controlled, you know, as much as my mum was, unfortunately, but because I wasn't that immediate person, I did have sort of, you know, an outer perspective of it as well. So that was a big problem, because I was in two minds constantly. I was so torn. And it's very easy for someone to say, well, how did you feel about the situation? Well, I don't really know, because one half of me was telling me, this is amazing, it's brilliant, I'm living on a farm now. You know, I love animals, as you know, I'm going into farming myself. So you know, I loved it and it was brilliant. And I'd never lived in, you know, such a big house with my dogs in the countryside, you know, doing something I enjoy. But then it was like, well, actually the family life isn't that great. This isn't right. We shouldn't be here. We should be somewhere else. So it was that constant battle in my head. But, you know, I'd always try and, you know, shut up the realistic side, you know, with the fact that I could just go out to the fields. It wouldn't matter what was going on at home. If something was going on, if there was an argument, I could just walk straight out the door, walk 100 yards, and I'd be just sitting in a field on my own. And I didn't have to listen to it. So therefore, I could ignore what was going on and therefore pacify the other half of me that was screaming out, get out, really. And I think that is so common in sort of abusive relationships. You pacify the inner person going, get out, get out, get out.
Yeah, I think that does happen a lot, the rationalization and the minimization of what's manageable and what's not, particularly if you can take yourself off outside and away from it. But I think it's really important what you said about your mum miscarrying three times, because miscarriage is just so emotionally distressing for a woman. And I mean, I'm pregnant now as we're recording this, and you know,
I was very aware of that. I was like, do I talk about miscarriages while she's pregnant?
Yes, no, do, because it's a very important part of the story. And it tells me a lot about his callous disregard for your mum, that he made it about him. And it should have been about her, because it is just so emotionally and physically and psychologically distressing. So he made all of it about him and his drama when he should have been emotionally supporting your mum. Now, that speaks volumes to me about the health of the relationship, that he was emotionally unavailable when she needed him. And he almost blamed, well, you told me actually, he blamed her and would say things like she was disgusting when she was bleeding. So the language and how he treated your mum in those moments of how you describe it really tell me a lot about him, that his psychopathology, it sounds like he was a narcissist and very self-centered and self-serving and egocentric. It's all about him. And of course, then you've got his friends calling him Lord and Lordy, which reinforces that even more. And he's used to getting his way. And it sounds to me like your mom, in a sense, was the people pleaser, unfortunately, who was trying to create a good relationship, but it was her who was always having to meet his needs. It wasn't the other way around. So again, that tells me about the health of the relationship and control issues. And I believe he was, just in terms of physical descriptives, wasn't he 6 foot and 18 stone? So he's a big guy.
Yeah, he was a massive guy. And that wasn't fat either, that was muscle. You know, he played rugby from a very young age. You know, obviously, like I said, he was a farmer. You know, so he was quite intimidating, and there was no need for him to actually be physical. And, you know, as far as I'm aware, from what I witnessed over the years, he never laid a finger on my mum. However, you know, I have doubts in my mind here and there. However, you know, and I did ask my mum several times, and, you know, I could tell when my mum was being honest. That, you know, I could always tell when she was telling, you know, lying and trying to fob me off, and when she was, you know, actually telling the truth. And, you know, I do believe that he didn't hit her. You know, there were times where I thought he did, but, you know, however, you know, when it comes to things like sex and things like that, I'm 100% certain, you know, that I have with no doubt that he, you know, forced her into doing, you know, into having sex when she really didn't want to, when she was tired. You know, and I, you know, he was very intimidating in other ways. He didn't have to be physical. He didn't have to, you know, smack her or throw down the stairs or that kind of behavior, because his size was intimidating enough. My mum was only 5'5", so she was only small, so that's quite a big difference. And she was only, you know, 10 stone, he was 18 stone. There's a massive difference, you know, in size, so he didn't need to intimidate her in that way. You know, there were times where he became physically intimidating when she sort of got a bit of confidence and would, you know, would have a go back at him, really. You know, there was a time he punched the pillow, you know, just as she was lying in bed, he punched the pillow right next to her head. And that only happened probably once or twice over the whole 7-year relationship. But, you know, that in itself is incredibly intimidating. So that immediately would, you know, my mum would be very taken aback by that. And because she took the physical side of it so seriously, anything like that would be, that to her would be major red flag, whereas the coercion and all those little things would, they might be like amber flags, you know, they weren't quite a big red flag screaming get out, you know, they were sort of, oh, okay, maybe that's a bit odd, but we'll deal with that. You know, and like I said, she was very forgiving, you know, always wanted to help people, and as you know, that, you know, they always come back begging for forgiveness. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, I won't do it again. So whenever that would happen, of course, being my mum, she said, yeah, okay, that's fine. You know, and she'd always put her emotion on the back burner. And like I said, you know, she wanted to make it work for me, really. And we had a very serious conversation before they got married. And I said to her, I said, please don't ever put me through what I've been through again, you know. And there was an element of guilt for quite a period of time after she died, surrounding that conversation, because I said to her, don't put me through it again. You either make it work or you don't get married, you know, because I can't go through another divorce. I just can't do that. I'd stopped seeing my dad in this period of time, you know, which was really difficult. It was a really big decision for me to make. And, you know, I'd already been through that physical relationship, and there was a lot going on, so that was a very serious conversation. So when she died, and it came out in court that she'd been sending messages to her friends saying, it's fine, I've only got to stay till George is 18 and she moves out, then, you know, we'll just make it work till then I can leave. So for myself, that was a massive element of guilt there, going, was that because of that conversation? You know, if we hadn't had that conversation, would she have stayed that long? You know, and it, not even just that conversation, but the fact that, you know, she wanted so desperately to make it work for me and to give me a good family, you know, a good stable family. Because I used to get upset all the time seeing my friends' families and how happy they all were. You know, she just wanted to give me the same. And, you know, that there was that massive element of guilt that, was that my fault that she stayed that long? You know, it was something I really had to come to terms with and to, you know, sort of get my head around after her death. But I managed to get my head around it. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just one of those things. No one preempted that what would happen, you know, what happened would have happened. But, you know, it's just hindsight's a wonderful thing. Let's put it that way.
It is. And you have to remember that you were a child in that conversation, and nowhere in your wildest dreams would you imagine that this would end in murder. And you were saying things from the child perspective that for you, you can't go through another divorce again. And so please make sure this is the right decision, which sounds like a very sensible counsel to give, actually. And your mum was the adult making the decisions. And for some of the, what she saw in him, it was the good stuff as well. And I think that's a very important point to make, because abusers aren't abusive all of the time. And we do hear often the apologies that go in, as you said, of all the apology and I will change, I will be better for you. But the problem is we don't often see the change behavior after the apology. But your mum was making those decisions based on what she felt was right at the time, and probably not in her wildest dreams did she imagine at that time that it would end in being stalked and being murdered. And oftentimes, Georgia, I will say, with all the families that I work with that have been bereaved because a man who is entitled decided to kill their loved one, families will say, well, we read about murders in the newspapers, but we never thought it would happen to us. So please don't feel guilt around what you said to your mum. And I mean that sincerely. No person genuinely thinks that a situation will end in murder. Certainly not when the red flags aren't all laid out, which it took some time in your mum's case. The red flags, when I look back at the case now and when we've talked about it, we see them. But before she married him, she saw that as a solution to some of the problems. But unfortunately, what we do know is that the marriage isn't a solution to the problems, that oftentimes things get worse once the ring goes on the finger. And I know that from when we've had conversations, that's when things got worse. So perhaps tell us a little bit about what was happening in the relationship, what he was doing, because I think you very astutely said he wasn't violent and therefore Mum didn't recognise the red flag. She saw amber flags, but when he did things like punching a pillow next to her, of course, he is exerting his physical presence. He is flexing to say, this is what I can do to you. Remember who's in power and who's got the control here. When he messes around with his guns, he's saying to her, remember, I'm in charge, I have the power and I have the control. And these things started to come out, didn't they? They started to play out once she was married. Paint the picture a little bit about what he was doing and what was going on.
I mean, yeah, you're very right in what you say with the intimidation and things. He didn't need to. That was a very rare thing that would happen, and it would be when you know, when she was getting her confidence back. Oh, I can fight back a bit, you know, and oh, he's really not that bad as I think he is, you know. And then bang, he would do something like that, and then it would be, whoa, okay, I messed up. He really is in control. But yeah, I mean, he was, first of all, he's really started just by isolating us. You know, I mean, like I said, we live in a rural area as it is. And, you know, I lived on a farm, so that's even more rural. And, you know, this is something I talk about quite a lot with, you know, rural abuse and urban abuse being so different. My mum was, like I said at the start, very sociable, very bubbly, always, you know, always with people, very extroverted. And then it just became more effort than it was worth to go out. And he would never, this is the other thing as well, because he never explicitly told her no, she never recognized it as being a big red flag. You know, it was never, you can't go out wearing that, you can't go out full stop. You know, it was just, he'd go in a mood, he would sulk, you know, he wouldn't, his favorite thing was the silent treatment. He wouldn't speak to us for weeks. I mean weeks. And you wouldn't know what you did because he wouldn't tell you what you'd done. You'd just get a particular look, and you'd just know, oh, here we go again, you know, kind of thing. So my mum then stopped going out because it was more effort than it was worth to go out. So she invited her friends over to the house. You know, we moved in with him. They were together 4 years when they got engaged. Then they were engaged a year before they got married. So we moved in when they got engaged. So they'd already been together a couple of years at this point. But because living separately, mum was still able to do things like go out and stuff like that because he wasn't there all the time. You know, he had a son of his own who's 4 years older than me. And who he had shared custody with his ex-wife. So when he had his son, we wouldn't really see him. Then when he didn't have a son, we would see him. So mum would invite people over to the farm. And then he would just humiliate us in front of those people, you know, or he'd be moody in front of them, or he'd just be, you know, rude, or he'd just be, you know, or he'd have conversations that just weren't suitable for that time. And he'd be very crass about things and, you know, just not appropriate behavior when you've got guests over, you know, particularly when, especially in the middle of the day as well. And, you know, when it's late at night and you've had like a dinner party and you've all had a few drinks, that behavior comes out, it's slightly different, you know, that topic, different topics of conversation between adults. But in the middle of the day when someone's just come around for lunch and, you know, there's no alcohol consumed and there's children there, there's certain topics you don't discuss, you know. But he would go out of his way to make people uncomfortable, so they never wanted to come again. And it was that isolation there. And then that was it. Once my mum thought, you know what, it's pointless having people over. So I can't go out, I can't have people over. Oh, well, I just won't see people. You know, and she worked long hours too. She used to finish work at, you know, six or after six in the evening. So it was quite a long day. So by the time she got home as well, she had a massive farmhouse to clean, family of four to feed, because he wouldn't do any housework. He was very much a believer of, I'm the man, I go to work, I get the money, the woman comes home, cooks and cleans. And there were many conversations about who worked the hardest, which is a daft conversation to have anyway. But he'd, you know, it wouldn't even start off as, oh, I work harder than you. My mum would make a comment, say, in the pub, and he'd just turn around and come back with some snide remark about how actually she doesn't work hard, or, yeah, well, I work 7 days a week, was his favourite thing. However, he was, you know, an arable and beef farmer, and we had sheep as well later on, but particularly, there's one example I can think of, and particularly at this time, you know, over winter, he just had, you know, the sheep were being managed by our shepherd, so he wasn't involved. He had some beef cattle, and the there was nothing to do with the arable because it's just growing, and there's nothing to do with the beef. All you have to do is go outside. So we had to walk 100 yards to the loadall, put some nuts in the loadall, but in the bucket, and then just go tip them in the shed. Then he'd go back inside all day. And then he'd say, yeah, well, I work 7 days a week. Yeah, well, you might have to do that 7 days a week, but that's only 10 minutes out of those 7 days. You know, that's not 8, 9, 10 hours out of those 7 days. Like, you know, my mum was working 5 days a week, but doing, you know, 9 till 6 or 6:30 in the evening. So that's quite a long day, especially compared to what he was doing. In summer, yes, he'd be working 12, 13, 14 hour days trying to get the harvest in. You know, but over winter, there was, you know, that was, it's a very seasonal job if you work in arable or something like that. So yeah, there was always that debate, and he just used to make my mum feel about, you know, this big, and it was very much she'd come home and clean. And even if she phoned him and said, can you just peel some spuds for me? No. Or he'd do it and leave a mess everywhere for her. Even something as simple as putting a plate in the dishwasher, he wouldn't do it. He'd leave it on the side.
So I think what you're describing is he had a very clear mindset about a woman's job and role and a man's job and role. And it sounds like he was a misogynist to me. The fact that your mom is doing so much, she was working hard, but she was also having to manage the house, do all the cleaning, look after the children. You know, these are huge, huge jobs, keeping the house in a way that you want to live, and also looking after your children and cooking after working a long day. But what he would say would devalue her and try and invalidate her and make her feel small and belittle her worth. Now, as you know, Georgia, that's, you know, the drip, drip, drip of that, when you're hearing it all the time, it really has an impact on your self-esteem and your confidence and your agency and your autonomy, because you start to doubt yourself. If this is how the person who loves you views you, and it is, it's insidious, this drip, drip, drip behavior. And it sounds like she was doing her best in every way, but he was intent on belittling her and making her feel undervalued, which must have been very difficult for you to listen to as well, because it's the impact on the children too, hearing these things being said for the next generation of what does that mean for your worth as a young girl growing up into a woman? And what does that mean for his son hearing that, the next generation of a boy's value is more important than a girl's and a woman's, the man is much more important. So these things are just so important, because it's not just about the murder in a vacuum. It's about the lead up of everything that was going on, this drip, drip, drip about control and how he controlled her. And it's all through the psychological, the emotional, the coercive, the physical when it's needed, right? The physical and sexual when it's needed to reinforce. But it sounds to me like there was an awful lot going on prior to him taking that decision to kill her, and unfortunately kill her in front of you, which, you know, when I heard you describe everything that happened, I just felt so angry. I felt so angry that he felt entitled enough to take your mother's life in such a brutal way in front of her daughter. I'm going to pause here and let you reflect and take in part one of this searingly honest conversation about events leading up to Cheryl's murder. Murder doesn't happen in a vacuum, and we're painstakingly going through beat by beat what happened to ensure people understand the warning signs. Unfortunately, Cheryl's case is not an anomaly.
neither is it a rare event. Femicide is currently at an all-time high. A woman is murdered by a man every 3 days in the UK. A woman is murdered by her current or former male partner every 4 days. Yet despite this, on Thursday the 15th of April, government decided to vote against our amendment in the Domestic Abuse Bill for serial domestic abusers and stalkers to be included on the same database as sex offenders and terrorists. Now, they stated that adding a new category of serial perpetrators to existing arrangements would add, in inverted commas, complexity to the existing system. Well, we believe that complexity is needed. Plus, it will clarify that serial domestic abusers and stalkers must be flagged, and they must be included on the same database as sex offenders and terrorists because they're so dangerous, and they should be managed by the multi-agency public protection arrangements. We believe that that will ensure that those perpetrators are held responsible and accountable for their actions for the first time. And we don't need more guidance, which is what they're proposing. We know more pieces of paper will change nothing. Now, we're going to continue to fight for this change. We know that this needs to happen to save lives, and we're going to get louder to ensure women and children matter and that they hear our voices loud and clear. So please support us by sharing this really important interview with others, and in doing so, amplifying George's voice. You can help by writing to your Member of Parliament if you're in the United Kingdom and ask them to support our campaign. You can also sign the petition, which is in the show notes. And please be an upstander and take action and share this on social media, because women's lives really depend on it. So be sure to join me back in the intelligence cell for the second part of this really important interview with Georgia. Until then, be curious, ask questions, and always trust your instincts. And here's my final 2 cents before the episode wraps. The first is a huge thank you to all of you, my lovely listeners and crime analysts, for tuning in every week. The second is an ask. If you like what I do, please take 2 minutes to leave a 5-star review on whichever platform you listen to me on. It really helps others find me and helps with the ratings. So thank you, thank you. Crime Analyst is written, produced and hosted by me, Laura Richards. Sound engineering by Tim Hansen at Half Ogre Studios. Cover art and graphics by Chris Rowbottom at Syndicate. And music by Killrude.